Welcome to Roseville Lutheran's 8-week podcast series, Hope in the Healing, with Pastor Lauren Reitzman. Join us this fall as this series allows us to listen in on conversations of faith, justice, politics, and more. Throughout the past month, Pastor Lauren has had the pleasure to talk with local and national poets, musicians, writers, and educators as they discuss not only their work and calling in the world, but also how they are finding hope in these times of pandemic and social unrest. This speaker series has been funded through a gift by the Roseville Lutheran Church Endowment Fund. Welcome to Hope in the Healing.
I'm speaking today with Angela Denker. Angela is the author of Red State Christians, Understanding the Voters Who Elected Donald Trump. She's also a Lutheran pastor and veteran journalist who has written for Sports Illustrated, The Washington Post, Christian Century, and Christianity Today. She's pastored congregations in Las Vegas, Chicago, Orange County, California, Minneapolis, and rural Minnesota. To write Red State Christians, Angela spent the year 2018 traveling across America to interview Christians and Christian leaders in red states and counties. While spending time with the people in her book and her own loved ones living in red states and counties, she found surprise, warning, opportunity, and hope. In retelling those stories, she hopes to build empathy and dialogue without shying away from telling hard truths about the politicization of religion and the prevalence of Christian nationalism in churches across America. Angela lives in Minneapolis with her husband and two young sons. Angela, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for taking time out of your day to have this conversation. I'm curious, just as a pastor myself, how is your family, your church family? How are you doing during this time of pandemic?
Yeah, thanks. It's so interesting because I always tell people this has been a hard time to be a pastor, and at the same time also such an important and critical time to be a pastor. So I feel grateful to be in this work, and not just in this work as a writer, but also getting to walk through this time in our country with a congregation, because I think that that really kind of keeps you grounded, and it also forces you to put the things that I write about into practice. So that's been really important to me. My family, we're trudging along. You know, the boys are getting closer as friends, which I think has been fun. They're 4 and 7, and so prior to the pandemic, they spent a lot of time separately, and now they're forced to kind of be each other's best buddy. So I've been encouraged to see that, and we're just taking it one day at a time as much as we can.
Absolutely. Well, you received your degree in magazine journalism, I believe it was, from the University of Missouri. You then, after that, I don't know what the years were, you went on to receive a Master's of Divinity degree from Luther Seminary. Mm-hmm. What led you on that path to ordained ministry? I understand, was it your grandfather who was a Lutheran pastor?
Yeah, so my mom's dad was an ALC pastor. He served primarily in rural Nebraska, and then served in Kansas City during civil rights. So he was really a pastor at a critical time in American history, and that was an important part of his calling. But then my dad's family is Catholic. So on my dad's side, when I was thinking about becoming a pastor, it was like, what? What are you thinking? So I think for me, I am someone who, from almost as far back as I can remember, I just felt a special closeness to Jesus. You know, you can find me as a kid praying in my bed at night, you know, on my own. Going to Baptist Bible camp actually was a formative experience for me. But also attending Lord of Life Lutheran Church in Maple Grove, which my parents began going to when it was meeting in a school as a church plant. And then I kind of grew up with the church. So I got this unique experience of being in a small church and then being confirmed with 200 students. So just somebody, I always felt that closeness to God. I remember in junior high, I took one of those career surveys of what careers you should have. And I think clergy was way at the top. But at the same time, I also really felt strongly that I would not go directly into ministry, that I felt really called to do something else first. And for me, that something else was always journalism. I was initially interested in political journalism and then kind of found myself drawn into sports writing and got to have this amazing sports writing career and worked in Florida, worked in Missouri, got to cover the Super Bowl, do all these incredible things as a sports writer. And really my calling into journalism, you know, people have so many different opinions about the media today and where are we finding truth? But for me as a journalist and what I was taught at the Missouri School of Journalism was that in its idealized version, in the version that I wanted to pursue, journalism is a pursuit of truth and telling the truth and giving people access to the truth. And as a Lutheran, you know, during the Reformation, one of the proudest parts of my history is to think that Martin Luther was instrumental in giving people access to read the Bible in their language and so that they would have direct access to the truth. So for me, all the threads connected. And after working a number of years in journalism, I applied to Luther. I deferred a year because I just felt like I needed to take that time to prepare my life for ministry. I was spending most of my time, you know, late nights covering hockey games, you know, going out with the team after the games and just the lifestyle of a sports writer, which is really different than, you know, lifestyle of seminary. So I took that time. But then I really remember the crystallizing moment for me was sitting on the bus on the way back from the Super Bowl. There's media buses. And just at this pinnacle moment of sports writing and getting to be in the locker room after the game, Kurt Warner, the quarterback for the Arizona Cardinals, he was getting ready to retire after a year. In these critical moments that are so important for so many Americans and for me as a longtime athlete and sports fan, but I still felt this tugging underneath that was thinking about seminary, even sitting on this team bus coming back from this moment of sports writing. So in that moment, I just made the leap and the decision to go to seminary. And then the road has continued to twist and turn ever since then.
Well, it's almost as if, you know, in your book, The Red State Christians, you're marrying all of these different passions that mm-hmm. you have. You know, you speak about the truth, you speak about your work in political writing, and then you add this layer of the faith element. Mm-hmm. What was kind of the inspiration and kind of that work that you did in not only dreaming up kind of the concept of this work, but also the research that went into it?
Yeah, I think part of what I learned in the process of writing Red State Christians and then having it come out in August of 2019 and then seeing what's happened since then, what I really learned that was, for me, I really think the greatest gift of the book was actually that year that I got to spend in 2018 traveling and researching and talking to people all over the country. It really was, as you talk about, these different passions of mine and these different gifts that God has given me, whether for interviewing or for understanding the theological underpinnings behind so many things that are happening in American politics and at churches. That all came together for me in a really powerful way. And the story behind Red State Christians is kind of interesting. So I was serving in Southern California in Orange County at a large Lutheran church out there. Lutheran church, but sort of operated in a lot of ways more like an evangelical, not quite mega church, but, you know, similar. And so the other pastor who I worked with and myself, we had both gone to Lutheran seminary. But the majority of our staff came from the evangelical world, our worship leaders, our music leaders, our different ministers. So there was a huge influence of evangelicalism, of Southern California mega churches like Rick Warren's Saddleback, Crystal Cathedral. And so I really felt like I was sort of indoctrinated a little bit into that world of the power of American evangelicalism and the wealth of American evangelicalism in Southern California. And I was there during the 2016 election, the 2016 presidential election. And so I also got to see firsthand, you know, a lot of people here in the Midwest think of, well, Southern California, that's this crazy liberal place. But actually, Orange County is deeply conservative. So I really felt like I kind of had a front seat to watching how conservative Christians, how evangelical Christians became a part of the coalition that elected Donald Trump, and just watching some of the ways that that played out politically and played out in my own congregation. And to see too that every time there's a presidential election, of course, there are families that are divided and there are churches that are divided. Mm-hmm. But this election in 2016, those divisions seem to run even deeper and along some racial lines, some gender lines, in ways that some generational lines. And so I saw that in my own congregation, even watching in the weeks after the election, you know, people maybe wouldn't sit together for coffee hour afterwards. And so that was just continuing to watch how that played out at my own church and also in broader American evangelicalism. I was sort of taking notes as a good journalist watching all this. And when we made the decision to come back here to Minneapolis, my parents are here, my husband was offered a job here, I approached at the time 1517 Media with a book proposal called Bibles and Boob Jobs, which was sort of marrying, you know, the public perception of Southern California of image, plastic surgery, you know, all these things. And in some ways, some of those things that Trump drew on as well, which is wealth and image and success and his role in reality TV and the Real Housewives of Orange County, all these overlapping things. And so I approached them with that book, and they came back to me saying that they had really been wanting to do a book, ideally from someone who had a pastoral background, but also someone who had a reporting background, looking at the broader Christians, red state Christians, who had been Trump voters, who had lived in red states and red counties, and sort of telling their stories in a way that hadn't been told in national media. And so they asked if I would be interested in doing that. And that sort of led me down this road of looking more broadly, not just at my experience in Southern California, but also thinking about the stories of some of my relatives in Missouri who had become big Trump supporters, but in a different way than the evangelicals in Southern California. There were different things that were important to them. And it became really important to me to tell different stories and to tell individual stories, but also to look at some of the broader trends that were happening nationally and interpret them through a theological and a faith-centered lens.
You know, and you talk about, you know, that experience even after the election of people within your church no longer sitting together for coffee. And in the introduction to the book, you write in part, "This book is my answer to the call for greater engagement and conversation at a time when America feels pulled to its extremes, when our first national impulse is to block and unfriend anyone who disagrees with us." So you were researching this book in the early years of the Trump presidency. Now we're in 2020, which is not only a presidential election year, but also it's a year that's given us the crisis of a pandemic, peace marches and riots, as we strive for equality and justice. How has the research that you did for this book helped you understand who we are in America today? Do you feel like we're actually answering that call for greater engagement and conversation during this time of just crazy extremes?
Yeah, and how do you have greater engagement when everyone's, you know, confined to their homes? I mean,
absolutely, I know. It is.
I was thinking that when you were reading that I did. I wrote this before George Floyd. I wrote this before COVID. And so I think it's been interesting for me to watch how that tendency to divide, and then how there's also been stories of seeking to listen and to understand in the midst of all of that. And it's been interesting to watch which narratives have become more dominant and which have not. So I remember just before really COVID hit the United States, in February, I went down to Naples, Florida, and did a presentation in Naples. And the county that Naples is in, Collier County, is one of the most conservative counties in Florida. And so I was doing this presentation on my book, and it was the same day, not only of the Iowa caucuses, but it was also the same day, and I can remember now, but it was also, I think, the same day that the Senate voted on Trump's impeachment, like 20 minutes before I was coming to give this talk. So I was thinking, you know, how is this going to go? Are people going to just feel overwhelmed? Are people going to want to engage with this when we're in the midst of so much news? And I think back to that event because what I found was really, really encouraging, actually. And I found this again and again in a lot of the events that I did, which tended to be in more conservative areas, across the Midwest, across the South, in North Carolina, in Missouri, that I think what national media headlines say, and too often what national leaders say, is that people really hate each other and people are really unwilling to engage or to be challenged. And what I found more often, especially when it came to talking about Christian nationalism, for example, and how Christian nationalism relies on a distortion of the gospel of Jesus that many of us have heard in our churches, but has become fallen sway to really talking more about power in Christianity and less about Jesus' forgiveness. People were really willing to listen to that and to hear it and to be challenged. And so I think that there, people still have that ability and there's still really a hunger to be better. You know, that America was really built on, you know, I don't buy that our founders were, you know, these devout Christians and that everything was wonderful at the founding of America, and that because especially as a woman, you know, I didn't have any rights at the founding of America. I didn't have the right to vote, and neither did people of color, neither did people who were poor, who didn't own land. But I do think what I do believe in is the dream of that first America, and that America has always been built on underneath the racism that has devastated our country, underneath the sexism and the discrimination against poor people that has devastated our country. There has always been a desire that Americans have to be better. And so much of that for me is rooted in a Christian faith and this idea that we worship a savior who died and who was so wanting a relationship with people and was so committed to the cause of freedom and liberation for all that he actually died on the cross. And that our greatest hope came in the moment of that death rather than in a moment of glory. So I think that gives me hope, and I continue to see that reflected in America. Well, at the same time, I think what so often happens too is that we're seeing right now, as you know, we just can't let COVID. It's still there. It's still growing. I'm hoping when people are watching this, maybe we'll be in a better spot. We'll see, or listening to this. But what I think that the hopefulness comes from is that even as the angry voices are getting louder and louder, and that part of that we can hold on to as Christians is that our faith is such that the presence of greater anger and hatred and evil is sometimes a good thing because it's being brought out into the light and we're being forced to deal with it and forced to confront it. And sometimes some of those things do have to die before there can be resurrection and new life and new hope.
I like how you speak of that resurrection because, you know, I think your family, my family isn't very different, that we have found ourselves and our families divided, mm-hmm. deeply divided, and especially in a political realm. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these divisions are going either unspoken about the whole piece of just don't mention politics at the Thanksgiving table. You'll upset somebody in the family. How have you, if you could share with us, have you seen some of that hunger to do better, that hope, even in the conversations that you're having with some of these people that you're intimate with within your own family that come from different backgrounds and states and beliefs? Have you been able to experience that yourself?
Yeah, I think so. And I do think, too, that it's really important to remember that something that's really important to me to hold on to is that being political and talking about things that involve politics does not have to be partisan, you know. Mm-hmm. And Jesus was indeed a political actor. He was so threatening to the political hierarchy that he was crucified by the Roman government. So as much as it would be easier to just say, well, we can't talk about any of this stuff, I think that, especially as Lutherans looking at the example of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his resistance to the Nazis, and also at the same time, Martin Luther and his complicity with agreeing with some of the persecution of the Jewish people at the time, we have to be aware that we don't operate in a vacuum, that our faith is impacted by politics. And I think as a pastor, I wouldn't be a pastor if I didn't think that my faith was relevant to the world outside the church. So that's, you know, I think that that's important to remember and to give people courage that we can speak on these things as Christians and that Jesus really does have something important to say, without it meaning that we're staking a partisan position. So I think that that's sometimes a tool that's used to silence people when we do need to be prophetic and looking at the words of the prophets about politics. But talking about hopeful situations, I was in Missouri the last couple of weeks to see my in-laws, and we were spending some time at, they have a little pool behind their house in their neighborhood, and, you know, COVID, so it's kind of like only a few people can be there at once, and but we happened to be there at the same time as a Black family, and I was thinking that, you know, it was not very many generations ago, maybe my mom's generation, when swimming pools were segregated. And now here we are in the same place, and, you know, my in-laws and I are different politically and how we think about how we've talked about what's happened in Minneapolis, and my belief that as Christians, you know, we needed to be a part of the protest for racial justice, and their belief that, you know, well, this is causing rioting. So all these things coming together in this one space. But what made me really happy is that our kids were the same age. This Black family and our family, our kids were the same age. And they were the ones who kind of socially distanced, wanted to start playing together and talking, which sort of led to some conversation between the adults. And as the other family was leaving, the dad made sure to say to us, you know, thank you so much for playing with us today. And I think I was so thankful that those kind of conversations can happen. And, you know, he was talking to my father-in-law and said, well, hey, we live, you know, we live just up the street. What house are you in? Maybe we'll see you out and about. And it's not like, you know, that's going to solve racial justice in America. And I'm not suggesting that major structural changes need to happen. But it does give me hope to see conversation happening between people and individuals and learning each other's names and realizing that when we see each other as human beings, as individuals, that it's much harder to say, well, this is Black Lives Matter is about Marxism. When you have a Black man standing before you who has had to deal with what it's like to be a Black man dealing with law enforcement in America and dealing with the history of segregation and civil rights. So I think that it's always important to humanize one another and not to see each other as agents of an evil ideology, but instead to see one another as fellow human beings who bear the image of God.
Absolutely. You know, in the conclusion of your book, you write these words, my red state Christian story began with Trump. Still, the place my story ends is far from Trump. It ends in places in America where people are forming unlikely alliances, surprising each other and surprising political pundits to build a future that looks nothing like the Republicans or Democrats of the past. Grace for American Christians and for all of us is a difficult thing. It means starting from a place where all of us have been wronged and knowing that we all have something to learn from each other. You know, as I read those words, I read kind of that sense of hope that you're speaking of the of the learning of each other's names. Mm-hmm. Difficult to do sometimes in times of isolation, but how important it is to name each other within our spheres, our families, our neighborhoods. You know, you spoke a little bit about this, but where do you find hope in the healing as we're kind of in these final months in this buildup to, again, a very divisive political election and season? Where are you finding and still kind of residing in that hope?
I love the passage, and I always would read it at my book events. And then I had to kind of laugh in the last few months whenever I read it, because I say, you know, we're building a future that looks nothing like the Republicans and Democrats of the past. And then, you know, Joe Biden is the Democrats nominee who very much represents the link to the past. So God always, you know, has different surprises in store for what the future will look like. But at the same time, I find a lot of that hope in a few different places. I find a lot of hope, and I always have as a pastor, in really looking to Christian leaders of color, whether it's leaders in the Black church, whether it's Latinx evangelicals who I met at the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso. But I really find a lot of strength as a white American pastor, looking to my siblings who are pastors and Christian leaders of color. And particularly I say that because as white Christians in America, even if, you know, maybe as German Lutherans, there was a little bit of a stigma being German and we had to learn to speak English. The leaders of the Black church really had to understand Christianity as a persecuted faith and what it means for Christianity to be always working in the shadows, always working on the sidelines, not taking for granted association with power and with money and with the government. And I think too often in the white church, we have assumed that, well, we're all on the same side, you know, and the church sometimes grows comfortable, and we grow comfortable as Christian leaders being surrounded by power and money and influence. And I think that sometimes we have to be careful about that, because whenever the church aligns itself too closely with power and with human government, the church gets itself into trouble of idolatry, and we start to idolize things like our buildings, things like our endowments, things like our education, our political standing, and we forget to leave the focus on Jesus. So I really find a lot of strength and hope in leaders who I know who have been working for a long time from a place of disempowerment. And in the same way, I also think I find a lot of inspiration and hope from the next generation, and just seeing ways that younger people, that high school students are wanting to be creative, to do things differently. I felt so heartbroken for high school kids in the midst of the pandemic, because there's no prom, there's no high school sports, there's no graduation. But these kids have been so, and young adults have been so resilient, and have really emerged as powerful voices about the climate, for example, about gun violence in their schools. So I really draw a lot of inspiration there as well.
What is the next project you're thinking of working on? I think when we spoke earlier, you said you'd had something that involved travel. And so now you're trying to like restart and recreate. What is that next project going to be for you?
Yeah, so I am very excited that the second book project is moving along. I actually have a trip planned tomorrow. So the travel has morphed. Now I'm just doing a short little research trip to Richmond, Minnesota, which is about an hour and a half outside the Twin Cities. But I'm working with a co-author this time. She's an expert in public health, and specifically in rural public health, and public health for Indigenous people, for Native Americans. So she and I are working together on a book about hope in America and how that hope in America is often best told through stories that have too often gone untold. So we're gonna be telling stories, particularly of women in rural America, and where they are creating hope, where they are sustaining systems and communities, and kind of telling those stories through her lens of her work in rural public health with the University of Minnesota and with Harvard, and my lens as working and understanding rural communities through churches and as a pastor and through spiritual health. So we're still working on a title, something about hope, something about the myth of rural America, something about what the new American dream looks like, because, you know, we've seen this American dream that, you know, one man can strike out and work hard and buy a home and get married and make it. I mean, that dream has been shelved and killed for so many of us. So what does the new American dream look like? So that's what she and I are working on. We're super excited.
That does sound exciting. And just that conversation of leaning into kind of that those places of hope, it's important for us to remember that in our Christian witness, hope still abides. Hope is still present and with us. Well, I want to thank you, Angela, for this conversation today, for helping articulate some of those things that have been kind of happening around us, for speaking so eloquently about grace and hope, not only for today, but into the future as well. It's just been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. You as well. And I love Rosa Lutheran. So thanks for all the work that you guys are doing. And you have so many awesome people in your congregation, many of whom I know. So I'm excited.
Wonderful. And you can read, if you're listening to this, more about Angela and her writings on her blogspot, agoodchristianwoman.blogspot.com. Did I get that correct?
Yeah. And if it's easier, you can go to angeladenker.com and kind of everything's there. You can click on the blog there too.
So. Wonderful. Well, blessings to you, to your family, to your church, your ministry, and all of the ways in which you are abiding in and living out the gifts given to you. It has been just a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Hope in the Healing with Pastor Lauren Reitzman of Roseville Lutheran Church. We hope you will join us throughout our 8-week podcast series as we engage poets, musicians, writers, and educators in conversations of faith, justice, politics, and more. Complete information about this series is at roseviellelutheran.org/hope, including a link to our online discussion on the Sundays following each podcast debut. Thank you for supporting Roseville Lutheran's vision of being a community united by grace.